There was, Madam Chair, there was a request by the Attorney General's office that they go to Ways and Means, but it does not have a sensible referral at this point.
Well, let's just wait and see. I guess we can, I suggest that they can pick it up on the, they can probably pick it up on the House side, or we can make a note of it, and we'll see what that does. We'll make a note to the Senate President, I guess, if you want, but I'm over that. What's your pleasure? We don't have the power to add Ways and Means
referrals
to it. We can make a note that the Attorney General has in testimony, thought that would be appropriate. We'll leave it up to the Senate President.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes. I would move that we have such a letter to the Senate President informing of the request to Ways and Means and let him take it from there.
Okay. In the meantime, Senator Hill moved Senate Bill 492 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
So one way or the other. They'll pick it up, and if it goes to the floor, it will come to us with a due pass, and they can apprehend it there and send it to Ways and Means. If we want to move it from the floor to Ways and Means, we'll do that, but I would prefer to.
So, Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 492 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Call roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Benn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. We'll send a little letter along and see what they do.
Yeah.
Okay. We have work session. We are here. Let's move to Senate Bill 376. It is the contempt bill, which was the rough amendments passed out last time. Okay. Ingrid, let's call up the. Who else is here? We've got amendments, further amendments.
That's correct.
Dash four amendments,
here.
Folks. Coming along.
yes.
Come on up. Who's primary spokesperson today?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The only amendment that we had was one that related to the limitations on contempts that were brought in the arena of non-payment of support. And we had some written testimony I was going to present, but I saw an amendment crafted by Mr. David Lowry, who's present here today as well, that I would endorse and ask the committee to consider. And that is, I believe, at Section 12 on page 5 after line 39, a new subsection in Section 12. And the language, I'm reading directly from Mr. Lowry's letter, since it's the only thing I have available. I would hope that he'd make a copy available for the committee. Section 2, he has labeled, beginning, contempt proceedings brought to enforce a support obligation against a support obligor.
Excuse me, I guess I didn't realize we were, well, never mind, we're into it now. I thought we were going to hear him sort of go through the bill.
I'm very sorry. I thought you were calling for amendments. My apologies to the chair.
Actually, I'd like to take these amendments. If you're way on page 12, I'd like to wait. Do you mind, Carl? But since you've been part of the working group, that's fine. Let's go through the working group amendments and deal, Ingrid, with Bill as we have them before we take up other amendments. Yes, it is the hand-engrossed amendments proposed by the Oregon Judicial Department March 20th.
That's correct, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And you should have the dash four amendments dated 325-91. Those are the amendments being proposed by the proponent of the measure and they do not all appear in the hand engrossed version because there have been some minor modifications made in the appeal language in the dash 4 amendments. Nori Cross is here from the Judicial Department to explain what those are.
Excuse me, those are meaning?
Meaning the changes which have been made in that appear in the dash 4 amendments, which are not in the hand engrossed version of the bill that you have before you.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I can go through. My name is Nori Cross from the Oregon Judicial Department, and if you would like, I can go through what those changes are. We did not have time to do another hand engrossed before the hearing today.
I would prefer that you go through the bill and that the committee adopt the bill, and when we come to the dash 4, need for dash 4, we will turn to dash 4 and include them.
Fine.
Very well, Madam Chair. The dash 4 does include all the amendments to date, plus some
right.
that didn't get put in the hand
plus some.
Bill.
I'd like to go through the hand engrossed bill then and deal with the committee's. Let's go to page 1 and go through the bill. And Ingrid, you have an issue on the first page, which is or isn't included in dash 4 amendments, which has to do with bad intent case law?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. Madam Chair, current case law, and I have copies of those cases for the committee members, if that would be helpful, requires that there be not only a willful contempt, but that it also be done with, quote, bad intent. And as a consequence, I think an issue is raised if we simply use willful, which this measure does, without any further reference to intent. So the amendments which are being distributed here, the dash 6 amendments, would address that particular problem by adding a requirement of bad faith.
David is here. David Henricks, you've drafted these.
For the record, Dave Henricks from Legislative Council's office. Madam Chair, yes, I drafted those at Council's request. It basically attempts to incorporate what seems to be present law with respect to the burden of proof with respect to showing a contempt of court under the existing law. And what those cases basically seem to indicate is that it's a two-prong test. You have to show both that it was, quote unquote, willful, the action that the person undertook, and also you have to show that it was done with bad intent. And that is a policy issue, I think, for the committee as to whether or not they wish to retain, either by some language or by some indication of legislative intent, as to whether or not that will remain the rule under this new structure.
Okay, Nori, I assume that did your committee consider this, did you affirmatively discard or decide that you were going to ignore the case law, or that wasn't necessary somehow? My statement is not pejorative. I just need to know whether you just made an affirmative decision not to include some language hooking us to current case law.
What we had understood the case law to be before the Cooey case. It just came down February 6th of 1991.
So this is a new case, yeah.
Yes. Was that willful meant with bad intent? That was prior case law dating from several years ago. What the committee had considered in several of its meetings was whether the standard should be changed from willful to intentional. For several reasons, whether intentional was a clearer standard or a better understood standard. if willful meant with bad intent, were they the same standard, were they different? And I think part of it was because this bill reflects some of the considerations put into the Wisconsin revision in 1979, where they dropped what their standard was at that time of willful and intentional and went with just intentional and had some commentary about what their standard meant. So one of the early drafts of this bill had used the standard intentional. And because we were trying not to change a lot of the current law in this bill, but trying to incorporate what the case law said about contempt and to make it clearer and to define the procedures better, we decided we would not change that standard and we would leave that as an issue for you. I think Bill Linden's testimony of February 6th indicates that that standard of willful versus intentional was one of the policy questions that we left to the committee.
Okay, folks, we're here.
You want a motion?
Yes, I would. What are you?
I would move the dash six amendments.
Senator Bunn has moved dash six amendments, which would further conform, I guess, to the case law, what is meant, what we mean by. Senator Hill.
Yes, in the as I understand the case law, as you've talked about it, you say bad intent, and what we have here is acts taken in bad faith. Is that the same thing, or what are?
I was not really involved in drafting those amendments, and I'm not sure that they are the same thing. And I would rather that Dave Hendricks and maybe Ross Shepard address that
to
question,
whomever.
Please.
I'm trying to remember, frankly, Senator, if that was the language in the Cui case or not. I whipped these out on Friday afternoon. I can't remember, but I think that's where that the flank language bad faith came from. If they use
bad intent.
Well, I think the words are bad intent. And you have here's bad faith. Mm-hmm. Since we're, I think shouldn't we use, if we're going to do, we should use the language that's in the case since that's what this is all about, it seems.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the important thing is to make it clear what the committee intends that it mean. And if you adopt the language of the case and indicate that that's what you are doing, I think that would be extremely clear.
Yes. Bad faith and bad intent,
yep,
I think, are different things, or at least could be. So if we're trying to conform it to the case law, then maybe we should use the same language, I would think.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, in fact, the case uses both of them. Therein lies the problem. It starts out indicating that the problem that the court had is that they failed to make a finding of bad intent. And then at a later point in the case, it indicates that the trial court did not find that he acted in bad faith. So,
Ross?
Good afternoon. I'm Ross Shepard. I represent OCDLA. I think that as a solution to this, I'd recommend to you that you not deal with good faith or bad faith or bad will, bad intent, and that you adopt the intentional standard as is defined in Chapter 161 of the Criminal Code. This is a standard that practitioners are familiar with. In a lot of these contempt proceedings, there's going to be a district attorney and a criminal defense practitioner. We deal with the term intentionally every day. So there wouldn't be any ambiguity, as there is with bad intent or bad faith. These are case law derived terms. There is no statutory definition for either one of those phrases. So you'll note that these contempt proceedings are most akin to criminal prosecutions, and for that reason, I think it makes sense to go to the criminal code for our definitions.
So you're proposing a different direction, and it would meet, and it is intentional.
Yes, it would just be intentionally, and it would be starting on page. On line 9 of page 1, where we are defining contempt, everywhere the word willful appears, I would suggest we insert the word intentional.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
Is intentional, Ross, is intentional defined in the statute then to comport an element of bad faith or bad intent?
No, Senator, it intentionally, this is in ORS 161.085, subsection 7, means that a person acts with a conscious objective to cause the result or to engage in the conduct so described. So this is where an alleged contemnor has either been ordered to do something or not to do something and consciously chooses to do just the opposite. That is a clear contempt.
Okay, so I think what you're proposing then is that we, in this statute, depart from the standard that the cases, including most recently the Cooey case, say is the standard for the state.
That's
because
true.
Because the defendant in that case was guilty of intentional conduct. The issue is whether he was also guilty of bad faith, and they haven't made a finding that he was, therefore they said that that was not sufficient to hold him in contempt.
Yes.
So you're saying that in the Cooey case, it should have been enough to simply find that his act was intentional.
Yes.
And that his good or bad faith is irrelevant.
That's my suggestion to you. I do not think in any way this is going to increase the burden on the prosecution for proof. Perhaps would even lessen it. But it is the highest level of culpable mental state found in the criminal code.
Senator Bunn.
Well, Madam Chair, it sounds to me like it would certainly lessen the burden on the DA if you take out the dash six proposal. The good faith or the bad faith element, just taking out one additional step. And personally, I would like to see as much protection as possible for the individual, and I think that is an element that the DA should have to prove, and so that we would maintain the case law by leaving the language. And whether it's bad faith or bad intent doesn't matter to me, but establishing clearly that we want that record to stand and we're not trying to change that threshold.
Madam Chair,
Senator Shoemaker.
To comment also, an important part of this bill is giving essentially a private right of action through the avenue of contempt and providing for essentially damages to the plaintiff in a private contempt action, and also requires bonds. It can lead to jail sentences. It can lead to a lot of sanctions against the defendant. And if we're going to allow that sort of third-party action within the contempt proceedings, which we propose to do here, I would think we'd want to stay with the development of case law that requires a showing of bad intent so that, I mean, if you read the Cooey case, I think you can kind of see how people can get themselves into that a fix like that, and I'm not sure that we want to encourage those kinds of private rights of action without some real wrong having been done by the defendant.
Okay. Any other comments from folks?
Just a question, Madam Chair.
Senator Hill.
I guess I get back to my original question about the amendments, the dash six amendments that have been moved. Do we have to have intent in there, or do you think the bad faith covers it?
Madam Chair, Senator Peel, frankly, in looking at it, I think I would prefer bad intent if we're going to use this, and for the simple reason that bad faith is perhaps even a little harder as a standard than bad intent. I don't know if you have it's about six of one and half dozen of the other. But
I think I agree with that. I don't think we're able to define one any better than the other. And maybe they mean the same thing.
Madam Chair, the most recent appellate court opinion on the matter, which is the Cooey case, uses bad intent as the standard. It does make a reference to bad faith once, but it goes in with bad intent and it comes out with bad intent.
Okay.
I think it's a little closer.
Senator Bond, you're going to be willing to include as a friendly amendment Senator Shoemaker's motion to take in to include to make it bad intent?
With bad intent
with
instead
bad
of in bad faith?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So it's will
that's moved
with bad intent.
Okay. objections to that side of it. These two together getting. Okay. Further comments?
Yeah. Well, I'm reading the second case here, which is kind of interesting. They've gone another step further and said willfully and with bad intent.
Yeah, we have willful.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if this is the appropriate spot, but it's in the same context as this section one. Again, thinking in terms of the third-party right of action, we define a contempt of court as a willful refusal as a witness to appear, be sworn, or answer a question, or to produce a record, document, or other object. I think it's the intent that this be a willful refusal to do these things after having been ordered to do so by the court. But it doesn't say that. And you could have a situation where in a deposition, a defendant refuses one of these points. And we wouldn't want that to lead to a contempt procedure, I wouldn't think. So I'm wondering if we ought not clarify this by putting language in those sub C and D that it is contrary to an order of court. It is a willful refusal as a witness to appear, be sworn, or answer a question contrary to an order of court. And similarly, willful refusal to produce a record, document, or other object contrary to an order of court. Would that be an appropriate clarification of what I assume the intent was here?
I think it certainly would.
Carl, do you want to kind of just pull up a chair and sit up here, since you're sort of the best... You're the closest DA that we have.
Chairs are going to separate. I think I get three.
Well, there's one in the corner, the far corner. Yeah.
Thank you.
We have a record for the name. Name for the record,
yes,
please.
My name's Carl Stecker. I'm the Marion County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the ODAA. Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, my only concern with such a limitation is that there's a current statute, discovery statute. I believe it's ORS 23... I'm sorry, I don't know. It's in the end of 23. I think it's 720, and it provides that a person may be held in contempt for failing to answer written interrogatories. Now, those interrogatories are issued without a court order. And so an amendment which would suggest restricting that to solely court orders, I think, would harm the current practice with regard to that kind of statute mechanism.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
What I'm concerned about is authorizing a third-party contempt action with all the sanctions that can lead to when what is being pursued is not specifically a specific violation of a court order. And in your interrogatory situation, I mean, that could lead to that. And are you advocating that a spouse who feels that she is being terribly abused by her ex-husband could have her lawyer issue interrogatories under order of the court but not reviewed by the court, and when these are not appropriately responded to, she could then, on her own, force a contempt action which could lead to imprisonments and fines and all kinds of...
I think that the current scheme of that particular statute is limited to the prosecution of such... a discovery mechanism through the district attorney. I'm not sure that it's a private cause of action. I would just be wary of any language which would tend to limit that. I'm not sure that that's available at this time privately.
Well,
so I would not, I guess I don't, I'm not here to speak for the private litigant that might want recourse through such a discovery mechanism.
I think that no one's trying to advocate that here, and so I would think that which Senator Shoemaker's on the other side of that, saying he doesn't want that to happen.
Doesn't want it.
You're saying that the only instance that you're aware of has the district attorney in control of those interrogatories, and that a private attorney couldn't force that action? Is that what you're saying?
Without examining the statute right now, it's hard for me to say what the statute requires, but I believe that it's limited to prosecutions by district attorneys or other similar support enforcement agents.
Excuse me. I think subsection E of the section 1 would answer the concerns of the District Attorneys Association.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah, I think you're right. So then, would that mean that inserting contrary to an order of court in sub C and D would be appropriate,
yes,
as far as you can tell?
Yes.
Everyone concur then?
Okay.
Oh, wait. Senator Hill, you had a comment?
No, I guess I was just going to ask if that situation occurred with those interrogatories, would you then ask the court to hold that person in contempt?
Yes, that is cause and reason then to file for a show cause for that purpose. That's right. And then you have an ultimate order, but the order relates not to violation of a prior court order, rather violation or refusal to answer on the discovery.
So I'll move then that...
Okay, let's dispense with the first dash six amendment first. We didn't really deal with that. And then...
I'm sorry, I thought we had.
Now, are there objections, and there may be, to adopting the dash six amendments moved by Senator Bunn with the changes, including taken with bad intent as a piece of that, striking out the use of bad faith? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, now, Senator Shoemaker.
Then I would move an amendment to line 15 and 16 by adding immediately prior to, 14 and 15, by adding in line 14 after the end of the line, contrary to an order of court, and in line 15 after the semicolon, and before the word or, contrary to an order of court.
Okay. Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Move on. Anybody else? I guess we'll take care of the deletion of sub 2 and that as a part of the adoption of the full dash 3 as we move ahead, okay?
Dash 4.
Dash 4, okay.
Madam Chair, there is one other item on that section that might be good to deal with. Paragraph E of subsection 1 of section 1 that deals with violation of statutory provisions. In looking back over that, I got to wondering why it didn't say willful either and couldn't think of any good reasons. And when I checked with Nori Cross on it, she agreed that...
Okay, so we ought to add... the chair would move addition of the word willful line 16.
That is part of the dash 4 amendments. I just wanted to mention that that was added at the last minute as because it was basically an oversight.
So that's included in dash 4?
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair? If willful then is to be a part of each of sub A through E, why don't we just put it up in the definitional phrase, contempt of court means the following acts taken willfully and with bad intent. Then we don't need to repeat the word willful as we go on down the list.
Well, we may just go ahead and repeat it anyway for the...
Just for the impact.
Yes. But I don't have a problem putting it up there. So I would... Go ahead. If you'd like to move it up, move it up to the contempt of court. I think it ought to be included in the definition too. Are there objections to that? And so ordered. Okay. Let's just move through the bill. And anybody who has a concern here at the table, yes.
Well, I did have one concern. I think Cooey was limited on its facts to the punitive contempt, so I'm not sure that it applied to the remedial sanctions. For, if I recall, in that case, I think it was remanded for resentencing because they imposed a determinate sentence, which was one considered to be applicable under a punitive sanction. And so I would question a wholesale revision of the definitions here as they apply to both remedial and the punitive sanctions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee might wish to look at the older cases relied on by Cooey because they do arise in the remedial sanction cases as well. That same language, willful and with bad intent. I have attached two other cases here, the Cooey case.
Do you have a recommendation then?
Well,
on the basis of that, we've actually moved that direction. We've moved them all in. You want to take it all back now?
I mean,
Okay. Okay. Let's move on. We have corporation, the question of criminal liability of corporations. That's section two. And Ingrid, tell us, or whoever's going to be prepared to tell us what the 1A is.
Madam Chair, I'm certainly wanting to do that. Mr. Hendricks is here and drafted it. He can tell you.
Okay.
Madam.
David.
Madam Chair, section two is a little bit of a strange section in that it starts out with just the general statement of inherent power, and for lack of any better place to put the liability of corporations, we tucked it in as section, subsection two to that section. Now, is that the, you want to have some discussion of that section or that subsection at this point?
I want to know where you got it and what it comes from and what it includes.
Okay. Subsection 2A, B, C are basically derived from the criminal statute.
Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Page two is a arrest warrant allowing, right? Anything further on that? Page five, we come to the issue of if committee members want to stop along the way, or if there are people from the work group that want to flag something, please do, because we.
Page three, Madam Chair.
Page three.
Again, a point of clarity. It's line 27, permitting the court to appoint a regularly licensed and practicing attorney to prosecute a contempt when a city attorney, district attorney, or attorney general won't do it. I'm sure it's implicit that this could not be the attorney for the complaining third party. But should that be explicit? I mean, you wouldn't want to permit the court to appoint the plaintiff's lawyer as the prosecuting attorney, would you?
Sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, if the person who should be prosecuting it as a government prosecutor declines to do so because it's either a conflict of interest, that attorney may be representing the person being alleged to be in contempt and held to answer, or if the district attorney or other prosecutor declines for other reasons, workload or whatever, the aggrieved party's attorney may be an appropriate special prosecutor. And I think that Supreme Court case law that recognizes that there is a right, U.S. Supreme Court case law that recognizes that there may be a right to a special prosecutor, discussed that, and that a party's counsel, an aggrieved party's counsel, may be an appropriate person to serve as the prosecutor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I certainly read Young to say just the opposite. This is U.S. Supreme Court case, Young ex rel. Wheaton versus, and it's at 107 Supreme Court 2124. It basically says, as I read it, that the court has inherent power to appoint a special prosecutor if the prosecuting attorney declines to prosecute, but that it was improper for the court to appoint the party's attorney in that case because this was a public function and it's an interference with the appearance of fairness and therefore a violation of due process to appoint that attorney. So I would read it that way.
And, Madam Chair, counsel, as I recall, yes, they found it improper in that case. I am not sure that it is so broad to say that.
Okay, well,
it could never be the case.
If Senator Shoemaker, I think we can put some language in there that said it cannot be the attorney for the
interested party. I think we can, I don't have a problem with putting that in, drafting further amendments to get that in.
Okay.
Pleasure of the committee? Is that okay with you? If there is some kind, I think this is, if two people read the same Supreme Court case and they get some difference of opinion, then I think we ought to make it clear. And I think I heard Senator Shoemaker suggesting that it should not be the attorney for the, in any case, it shall not be the attorney for the interested party.
Right, and the reason is that, as Ingrid Swenson said, I mean, an attorney has certain responsibilities, and the responsibilities to your private client are a different set of responsibilities than you have to the public if you are the public's agent. And to merge those in the same person in a contempt proceeding.
Okay. I don't think we need to argue it anymore. The committee is not arguing with you, as I hear them. We will. Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendment offered online? Where's it going to go? Basically, somewhere in. It'll be in sub three, another sentence addition. David, you got that? You're going to put that in there, essentially. Objections to that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Senator Bunn.
On page three. Line 16, dealing with the level of proof.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to throw out for discussion. I believe that when someone's incarceration is a question, that the level should be beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, this is dealing with remedial, but remedial, I guess they're not called punishments, but the penalties are just as severe as the punitive, and I think that the threshold of proof should be equal.
Yeah, I'm looking for the punitive side, and we have clearly articulated the punitive as being. Okay, where is that? Where's the punitive? I just want to make sure that I've located both languages, and we can kind of see where they are.
Madam Chair,
David?
At the bottom of that page, page 3, sub 6, it indicates except for a right to jury trial, the defendant is entitled to the Constitution statutory protections that the defendant would be entitled to in a criminal proceeding. Within those protections, the right to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, yeah.
Madam
Chair. I think there is a difference. I think that's one of the ways we do it, but Senator Bunn has offered his concerns. And that is, that's back for punitive, that's a punitive sanction, and Senator Bunn is...
Where is this?
Well, Senator Bunn is talking about page 3, line 16, and we are in that subsection, we are talking about remedial. And I was asking David about where is the language that deals with the whole punitive sanctions, and he's telling me that it's sub 6... on page 3, continuing on to the top of page 4, which includes the criminal sanctions being beyond a reasonable doubt. And I guess I think this is one of the distinctions. I'm going to argue against Senator Bunn's comment right now, or his offering of one, to change that by saying this is one of the areas that we actually clearly distinguish the difference between remedial and punitive sanctions. So I think there probably is a difference. We probably ought to have Carl talk about it, if there is a difference.
Madam Chair and Senator Bunn, there is a case in Oregon law under the Supreme Court has spoken in Hart versus Hathaway, and they've articulated the clear and convincing standard in the remedial types of contempts, although most recently, I can't recall the specific case, in terms of the punitive sanctions, they've articulated a higher standard, the beyond reasonable doubt. So were the committee to change that standard in the remedial, they would be overruling current case law. The cite on that is, I have a specific cite, 708 Pacific 2nd, 1137, and that's a 1985 Oregon case.
Madam Chair, is...
Senator Bunn.
Is that ruling because of a lack of legislative direction rather than, I mean... That doesn't tie our hands, does it? It's just saying that
you
can
overrule everything except the Constitution, probably.
We'll try that.
You can try to do that.
Okay, well, I would just come back to, when we take someone's freedom away, I would like the threshold of beyond a reasonable doubt. And I, clearly with remedial sanctions, that is one option that exists.
Okay, committee wants to take a, you've got, I don't know how we're going to deal with that. I'm waiting for the sense of the committee.
So. I'd make a motion, let it stand or fall, to replace clear and convincing on line 16 with beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, Senator, you've heard Senator Bunn's motion. I think we'll call the roll. Okay, call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
No.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
No.
Chair Cohen?
No. Motion carried. Okay.
Close one.
So that, I guess, means that then there's no sense in having a duplicate standard with respect to remedial or punitive, basically. If we go to that, then why? My question is to the drafters: why don't we just have one standard of contempt? And does it make a difference whether it's punitive or remedial? Still does, then.
Madam Chair,
still does that. Excuse me.
Go ahead. That's what Dave finished.
Still need to have. There are a lot of other things that follow from saying it's criminal beyond just proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay.
Everything, including right to cross examination and. There's a list of about five or six things that follow from that addition.
Madam Chair, even if we had an identical set of criteria to prove that contempt happened, we still have the two standards, or the separation in that one is a punishment and the other is to bring about compliance. So we have to keep them separate, but it doesn't mean that the standards for proving that the condition exists need to be different.
Okay. Let's move on. Next.
Okay. Page 3, I would throw out another option for committee discussion, and that is on line 44 on page 3, except for the right to jury trial. My preference is that we not explicitly remove the right to jury trial. So, well, if you would like an amendment to see where it goes, I would move to amend the bill by removing the first 8 words of line 44 on page 3.
Okay, let's talk about with the committee members to see what you're dealing with that on.
Madam Chair and Senator Bunn, this reflects current case law. Again, State X Rel Hathaway v. Hart found that there was no Oregon constitutional right to a jury in contempt proceedings. They did not follow the Brown v. Multnomah County analysis in deciding that issue. Under federal constitutional law, there is also no right to a jury trial so long as incarceration is 6 months or less. So this is current law. I believe the Judicial Department would have some concerns with changing that standard because it would certainly increase our costs in providing jury trials where we have not in the past. We would be increasing both mandated payments for juries and it would increase the length of the proceedings. That is, however, a policy decision for this committee to make.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Bunn?
I would argue that if you look at sentencing guidelines, and I thought I had a copy with me, but I don't see it now, so I'm not going to look for it, but you can find a whole array of felonies that 6 months, I believe, is about what somebody's doing. And we're saying, in essence, that we've got a 6-month time period here, and yet there's no right to a jury trial, and yet a whole bunch of folks are in Oregon's institutions for 6 months, and they've got all of those rights. I think we ought to give them the right to a trial by jury. If it's 60 days, I think we ought to give them a right to trial by jury.
Okay, Senator Hill.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I think that we're still talking about an issue here of prison and jail space. as to why the standards are the way that they are. We're talking about additional costs. Now, I can see if we want to, in terms of sentencing guidelines, I don't have that with me either, but I mean, to actually extend contempt beyond what's allowed in usual criminal situations, I think it does push it. Because I think if there are some other, I mean, we may as well then go back to having, I mean, we don't have, I think, any guidelines now, even for misdemeanors. Certain people, I think, are staying in jail for longer periods of time than that. I just think that I think there's a point where we have to, I think, be realistic about the cost here. And if we're talking about beyond six months, then I'm for it. But anything less than 6 months, going to a jury trial, I think is going to put a tremendous burden of cost. And I think we better be able to look at the cost and be willing to pony up the money for it. And in this climate that we're in right now, I have to say I'm just not willing to impose that cost in for these type of proceedings, if it's under 6 months.
Okay. Anyone else who would like to make a comment about that? We have Senator Bunn's amendment offered. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
No.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
No.
Senator Shoemaker?
No.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
No.
Chair Cohen?
No. Motion failed. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker?
Page 4.
Right.
Line 42 and 43 authorizes the following remedial sanctions: payment of a sum of money sufficient to compensate a party for loss, injury, or cost suffered as a result of a contempt. Does that include, was it intended to include consequential damages?
Who's, Carl, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, under current law, there's an ability for the court to award a, I think it's termed, I have to look at the statute, but I believe it's in the form of damages, in effect, for one's loss. It's in addition to indemnification, I'm sorry. The court is enabled to award costs to indemnify the party, which may include, for example, a loss of interest or whatever it is, if they've been deprived, for example, of the use of money, say, in child support.
But consequential damages can go way beyond that. If you lose a business opportunity, for instance, because the support wasn't paid and you can link it up, then you could possibly go for the loss of profits that you can prove you would have made in the business opportunities that you were deprived. Is it intended that in a contempt proceeding, as opposed to a cause of action for damages, that the contempt proceeding can be used then to the whole array of damages that the law accords?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I don't think it's contemplated that the contempt action or proceeding would be the vehicle to that. There may be a separate cause of action and a permitted filing based on the same conduct, but it would be a wholly separate action than the specific violation of the court order or whatever conduct was deemed to be contemptuous.
Do we need then some language in these two lines that would limit the damages that can be awarded in a contempt action in some fashion, and I don't know what that should be, but so that it isn't just another avenue for private right of action for damages?
Senator Cohen and Senator Shoemaker, Madam Chair, I'm not sure I can answer that. If you, as a policy matter, want to limit that language, we will certainly work with your committee counsel to come up with some language that will meet that end.
I haven't thought about it a lot, but it sort of seems to me that we should be talking here about sort of direct damages. And I'm not enough of a trial lawyer to make these careful gradations between damages.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, as part of the Tort Reform Act, it's now in ORS Chapter 18, they did distinguish by statute between so-called economic and non-economic damages. Certainly you won't want to cover what they designated non-economic, which are things like pain and suffering and those sort of things.
Right.
And I'm not even sure from the discussion that I heard here that you'd want to cover all that they listed as economic damages. But it is a nice list if perhaps after this meeting wanted to look through there and see what types of damages might be included in this type of award or should be included.
Maybe that would be an appropriate thing to do. Maybe we could work with Ingrid Swenson to come up with a description of the types of damages that a contempt action could lead to.
Well,
rather than just
maybe we could. Again, I don't think we can rewrite all of the statutes in contempt statute.
Well,
just because
isn't this supposed to be a kind of a comprehensive overhaul of the contempt statutes to rewrite it so that
to the extent to which you perceive. And what you're seeing here among committee members, I think, is a question of how much you're going to willing to give the judges flexibility in terms of how far they're going to, what kind of flexibility there is, and whether we can anticipate every circumstance of contempt, and or whether we're going to put broad limitations, I think, create broad avenues for them to act or broad limitations. I just want to put the thing in context of what we're doing here, which is, you know, it's not to say we can't limit it so tie down every instance, except that we may not be aware of every instance that you bring contempt in specific circumstances that might fall beyond that need remedial action, etc. And that's all I'm concerned about. I just want to make sure that we understand we are stepping off here into judicial discretion in some ways. And that's all. David.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I'm not sure I'd be too worried either, simply because these are authorizations. You know, the court can, if they want, award this. I think you would be somewhat foolish to rely on this to recover some of the more esoteric damages you might claim by bringing a contempt proceeding, because the court might very well say, no, I don't think that's appropriate in contempt, I'm not going to do it, and he'd have every right to do so the way it's drafted. It's just one of the sanctions they may impose.
I suppose it could create an appealable issue, though. It says that court may impose one or more of the following sanctions. If you then impose the sanction of damages as opposed to the sanction of confinement, it is to be payment of a sum of money sufficient to compensate a party for loss, injury, or costs suffered as a result of the contempt. But the judge, so you can imagine then the plaintiff saying, I want pain and suffering and I want consequential. The judge says, well, I don't think that's appropriate. I'm going to limit you to direct economic damages. The plaintiff appeals then and cites the statute. Says since they awarded some damages, they decided to award damages instead of confinement, then they were directed to make it a payment of money sufficient to compensate me. And to do that, you need to give me pain and suffering. You need to give me consequential.
Okay, I want to know the circumstance in which you'd get into a court in that kind of an argument on a contempt case.
Well,
because I think, Carl, you need to respond.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I think the extent of something that we've seen would be, for example, an employer who neglected to withhold monies as due on a wage assignment or judicial wage assignment order might be cited in for contempt of court. that an appropriate remedy for the harmed obligee in such an instance would be the time lost value of those funds, which would probably be represented by interest. And that, under the current statute, contemplated as an indemnification. I don't think it goes so far as to say that such an employer might be accountable by way of additional damages for lost business opportunity because the support payments intended for the benefit of the children were not, for example, made. So I think you can certainly bring a separate cause of action to allege that, but I don't think anybody's contemplating that to be within the scope of a contempt proceeding.
Well, it's hard for us to contemplate all the different types of contempt proceedings that might be brought under this third-party right of action that we're creating here, or that we are expanding upon here. I mean, there are infinite variety, and they could very well lead to a claim of damages in a very typical tort context. And I think it's a problem.
I don't think
it's a problem today, because I don't think we've changed anything here, have we? From today, this language doesn't change what's happening today, is it?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, I don't believe that it should. I mean, we had not intended it to. It is a change in the language because current language discusses indemnification. I don't know that any of us were particularly clear about what the limits of that term
are. So how many cases have you had of this nature under current law that would bring into call into context the circumstance that Senator Shoemaker is concerned about, because in fact it's been broader all during current law, and this proposes to narrow it some. So how much of a thing's been going on here that...
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, it's been very slight in terms of the number of cases where we've sought that. I would say less than 1% of the cases.
Where you sought it.
Where we have on behalf of the state, because we're not truly representing the interests of the private party.
How about the private party, though? Which now, I don't know whether the private party presently can pursue an action for contempt, but clearly under this bill,
well, this can. Would you respond to that, please?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, there are two avenues by which a private party can initiate an action for contempt under today. Under Chapter 33, a party can make a motion and request by filing an affidavit and request an order to show cause to bring a defendant to court, and they have to join the state as a nominal plaintiff in that proceeding. So it is a separate proceeding in which the state is often a nominal plaintiff. Under ORCP 78D, there is what is called an alternative motion procedure, which is the old equity procedure from Chancery days, that allows private parties to bring a motion in an existing case. There is very little other procedure specified except for a few references to Chapter 33 provisions that apply, such as right to counsel. And otherwise, apparently, the proceeding is conducted as under other civil procedure rules.
And do those two avenues, can they lead to private damages?
Because I don't practice in the area, I haven't sought those sorts of damages. But certainly, at least under Chapter 33, there is provision for this indemnification, which has included various types of costs and injury. I do not know personally whether there are cases where compensatory damages have been caught, have been awarded, or whether pain and suffering may have been awarded. For example, and I can imagine in a violation of an abuse prevention restraining order, that an injured victim who seeks remedial sanction under current law would seek some pain and suffering if they were badly injured because of that violation of the restraining order. But I don't know that it happens.
I guess I'd kind of like to learn before we...
Well, we've been learning here for 6 weeks, folks. And it's time to
I have.
You need to look then at the current statute and satisfy yourself with whether in fact we are expanding or restricting the current private right of action that comes in under a contempt of court. I hear from the witnesses out there I hear that the statute is there that allows the private party to come in for indemnification. And I trust to say that she's correct to say that private parties can come in and request indemnification. Somebody's going to have to research how often that has happened under current statutes and whether one would expect that if you put this in, you would either expand that or restrict that. People who are in the work group, I think, are saying there is now currently in two places an opportunity to come in for private right of action. And at least in one place, you can ask for indemnification. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nora.
Madam Chair, that is my understanding. I just don't know how broad the term indemnification is.
But there isn't any restrictions on it.
Madam Chair, not that I know of.
Except by case law, maybe.
There may be, but I am unaware of it.
Okay.
I'll not do any more damage.
You can do damage. I mean, I don't mind if you do. I mean, I think you just need to be, you need to get clear, and if you want.
Well, I raised a question, Madam Chair, with all due respect, to which no one knows the answer.
Well, I think they gave you a qualified answer, but I suppose we could research and find out whether anybody ever has and what the court's idea of indemnification is.
Madam Chair, I will certainly consult with other members of the committee to see if I can get an answer for you on that matter. It may be a policy decision that you want to give some direction to the courts on what you believe are appropriate damages that should be considered compensation in a contempt proceeding as opposed to some other civil action for compensation.
So we'll do a little research on that and come back to find out whether this, in fact, does broaden it or limit it. And the fact is we're not creating a brand new private party action that's never been there before with this bill. Okay. Anything else? Senator Bond?
Madam Chair, I see we're losing members quickly, but there are a couple of things that I'd like to bring up. One is suggesting that we change the 6-month confinement on